Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
I thought I was dead. I really did. I was like, this is it. And the revelation in that moment was, Jesus, what a miserable life. I was thinking, I was like, yeah, you had a couple of businesses, you were a chef. Nobody's going to give a shit in 6 months. Like, he's like, what a meaningless load of shite that was. Like, really, that's what I was thinking about. It was like, you know, you're
brilliant.
It was a good realization. So I just, that's when I decided if I lived, somehow I would change my life completely.
And that was the moment that everything changed for Niall Harbison. And it wasn't a moment too soon, because not only was he desperately unhappy with how he was living his life, but his addiction to drink and prescription drugs had brought him to the point of near death. Niall's story is a brilliant one. It's a fascinating one. I adored talking to Niall. He was a very successful entrepreneur, having set up and sold a social media marketing agency and the very popular and sometimes controversial Lovin' Dublin media brand. But a combination of burnout and partying a little too hard, a little too often, led him to cut ties with Ireland and start a new life, and a calmer, healthier one in Thailand. But unfortunately, things got not better, but worse. And he woke up in hospital one day and promised himself that he was going to turn his life around. Today, Niall is one of Thailand's most active stray dog welfare champions, rescuing, feeding, and sterilizing as many of the millions of dogs as he can find. He's happy, healthy, and living a meaningful, impactful life. And I'm delighted that he was my guest on the Mario Rosenstock podcast and turned out to be one of the most, interesting conversations I personally feel I've had in quite a while.
I would be the only person then for the third day drinking. And by the third day, I'm scared of the world, don't want to go outside. So I'll just get 12 cans of Guinness and I'll watch two football games and I'll just drink at home. But then by the Sunday, you're waking up at 11 and you've got the shakes and you're like, sure, I'll just get straight on the wine because that'll stop the shakes. And, you know, by the end of it, you're absolutely drinking on your own, miserable, don't want to go outside. I said, right, I keep failing here at getting sober, so I'm going to go and try and do it in Thailand. I just wanted something different. And then the alcoholism and the depression and everything, I said, I'll just clean break. Let's start a new life.
Did it work?
No, it got worse. I was like, okay, the goal today is drive down to a little local park and you've got to walk 1K. Some days I had to put it off. I'd be standing at the door being like, okay, well, this is it. We can do it. We can do it. Oh. And then I'd be like, no, back to the sofa. We'll tackle that tomorrow. Like, my mum walked out when I was like 12, 13 years old, just vanished overnight and left us for another man. And when I thought we were a happy family. So I think dogs are really, really loyal and they'll never sort of walk out on you. They're always by your side. They're just so simple, loyal, beautiful, fun, loving creatures.
But first, can you take your eyes off Wimbledon? It's that thing, isn't it? When we were kids, we used to put the net on the road to pieces of wire or whatever, or rope, and get our tennis rackets out and do it for 2 weeks every year. And it's all over the screens again, Wimbledon, the beautiful luscious green grass, that the nostalgia that it brings back, and the beautiful, you know, crispy whites that they wear, and that distinctive sound of ball on racket, and the tradition and fascination that Wimbledon holds for many of us. And it's on again, but it's not on RTE. RTE never seemed to carry it anymore. Maybe it's because they have no tennis commentators that could probably do it justice. But what if RTE could carry Wimbledon? Could they? What would it sound like? This is what it would sound like.
Well, you're very welcome back to Wimbledon. And I have to say, the place is a sea of strawberries and cream here today. This is a huge match between this Spanish fella, Carlos Alcaraz, I think they call him. He's only about 5'11" and 12 stone. He's a tiny little fella. Anyway, he's up against the Croatian Marin Cilic. Now, this fella, he's an absolute monster. He's 6'7" if he's an inch taller. Anyway, he's serving. They're coming down at about 140 miles an hour. Can you imagine this, that kind of speed going through the Jack Lynch tunnel coming at you? Anyway, let's go over to court two and join Marty Morrissey.
Thank you, Donald Lennon. From Kazakhstan to Miami. From Chile to Perth, Australia, they have come to SW19 in London for this historic occasion. Tennis, hurling with fluffy balls. And here are the favourites for the doubles match. Oh, the Americans, they get the ball, they throw it. It looks good. It's over. Oh, no! It's in the net! It's in the net! It's in the net! That must be 3 points. Or is it? No, it's not. The referee said, the umpire says that's a bad thing. I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Let's go over to centre court and join RTE horse racing commentator Des Scal. Des!
Thanks, Marty. And you join us with 3.5 hours to go in this Wimbledon handicap hurdle. It's Novak Djokovic, the 3.5-1 favourite, against Jannik Sinner, the Italian. Sinner. Djokovic. Sinner. Djokovic. Djokovic, Sinner. Sinner coming up on the outside. Here's Djokovic now. Sinner and Djokovic and Djokovic. Djokovic here. Sinner. Sinner. Djokovic. Djokovic. Sinner. Sinner makes it. Sinner makes it. Sinner. Sinner takes that one. And we're going to start all over again and do it again. And I think that's the way it goes anyway. Back to you.
I'd love to see RTE trying to do Wimbledon. An exclusive comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Please contact me if you'd like. MarioRosenstock@gmail.com. I take them all. I read them all. Constructive criticism, overt compliments. I love them all. Tell me who your ideas for guests would be. Ideas for sketches. Ideas for new characters that I haven't done. Give us a blast. MarioRosenstock@gmail.com. Okay. Time to meet Niall Harbison, an interview I genuinely enjoyed so much. I really enjoyed Niall's warmth and honesty. And his ability to answer a question really fully and then stop. I really enjoyed that. And then it would lead very nicely on to the next question. As I mentioned earlier, before Niall moved to Thailand, he was a successful digital and social media entrepreneur. But before that, he was a very successful chef. Here we go.
Yeah, I used to work in Dublin in a place called, you might remember, a guy called Conrad Gallagher.
Oh my God, I did Peacock. Chef. Peacock.
Yeah.
The Peacock
on South William Street there. Yeah. It was a mad place. That's where I started chefing. And it was, Jesus, it was like a baptism of fire is the only way I could describe it. It was a mad place, but really exciting. Yeah.
I remember I went to that restaurant once and I remember, do you know who was there at the same time? Jerry Ryan was there that day. And I think he was being wined and dined by a load of marketing executives. And I remember Jerry taking the piss and just ordering the most expensive red wine on the menu just to take the piss out of the fact that he was being brought out to lunch, you know, that kind of thing. So it was really, it was the epitome of Celtic Tiger, wasn't it?
Oh, it was 100%. It was like pure Celtic Tiger. Like, yeah, I think Anglo bankers would have been on one table, Jerry Ryan on the other, Ronan Keaton on another. You know, it was real. It was actually kind of funny, to see it. It was the height of, everybody was having a good time, I think.
But we were all getting notions as well. We were so notion-filled.
Big time. I think it was the MTV Music Award or something. I remember was in Dublin. And that they were all, the after sort of party was in there that night. And it was real high flying. Nobody was watching the pennies back then anyway.
So you were sort of a chef and you were working in sort of high end areas, restaurants. Were you working on ships as well? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the thing about kitchens is it's if anybody's worked in the hospitality industry, it's so hard. And I worked in kitchens in Dublin for about six, seven years, and I just had to get out of it. I was burnt out, and I went to work as a private chef. So I worked for really rich people, and you just have to cook for one or two people and you get to fly around the world with them. So it was a career change that was badly needed. So I got to travel. That ended up not being as glamorous as it sounds either, but it was a much better way to live life.
Give me an example. What are you doing? You're talking about rich people. So what are you? You're not living with them, are you?
You are, yeah. In some cases, I used to mostly be on their yachts, which are down in the south of France or the Caribbean. But then sometimes you'd live for them. I worked for one businessman. I just was in his house in the staff quarters, for want of a better word. And they're like, if you think how, like, these are like people who are worth 20, 30 billion. So, you know, having a chef is not a big luxury for them. So they, you know, you travel around with them, and the chef, funnily enough, along with maybe their personal assistant, the chef is pretty important because it's what they eat every day. So you're quite close to, you know, their decision making and stuff like that. I mean, only about food, but yeah, it was quite an interesting world to see.
What was your experience of rubbing shoulders with very, very, very super rich people?
I think the one thing would be that mostly they're okay. They're just normal. You know, they're normal enough as much as can be expected. But it's the hangers on that are the problem. The sort of management and the, you know, their assistants and then the guests who get notions. You know, like they'll invite on a bunch of guests, movie stars, whatever, and they'll sort of take the piss, for want of a better word, out of the hospitality and the staff and stuff like that. But yeah, the rich people, I mean, I don't think people really understand the scale of wealth is the thing. You know, when you open up and you see Jeff Bezos's wedding or whatever, like you think you know wealth, but you don't. Like, they're just, money is just no object. Like, you know, they'll fly. I remember in the Caribbean and the guests would want, they'd want mozzarella, but they wouldn't want, you know, you couldn't just get it from Miami or wherever. They'd send the private jet and fly the mozzarella over directly from Italy. You know, stuff like that is not out of the ordinary. I mean, it's peanuts for them. It really, like, when you're worth that much, it's just, I don't think people understand how much money they have. It's ridiculous.
And like, presumably because you're in the hospitality end of it, you're sort of witness to like all the sort of partying and all that sort of stuff. Is partying kind of, apart from the fact that it's money, and that there's a lot of the pillows are more gold, or the cushions are more gold. Is that it? I mean, do they all go, oh, Jesus, Tony, it's 3 o'clock. I think I'll turn in. Or do rich people party in a different way as well?
I think there's a good one from an Irish context. The yachts would always be at the Cannes Film Festival, which was like recently, you know, they'd go there every year. And I remember one time clearly, I worked for a guy called Paul Allen. He's dead now. I founded Microsoft, and he had the biggest yacht.
Even now, we know his name.
Yeah, huge big yacht, and he was actually a sort of a good billionaire, for want of a better word. He kind of just had fun with it, and he was big into music, and he would get like U2 recorded one of the parts of one of their albums on there. So afterwards, he would have all the band up in his studio in the yacht. He'd be up there jamming with them. So I think there's a different level. Like he's into music. He just gets U2 in there and he starts jamming on the drums and, you know, playing along. So there, you can do whatever you want basically when you're that wealthy.
So you were working for Paul Allen, yeah? And does that mean like, sorry, forgive my ignorance. Does that mean like somebody like Bill Gates would have come onto the boat, or you would have seen Bill Gates or Steve Ballmer or those guys?
Yeah, yeah. I actually cooked all of their 50th birthdays because they must have been around the same, you know, I don't know if they went to college or something together, but I remember the 50th birthdays all came in a row, and there was Bill Gates' 50th, Steve Ballmer's 50th. And I'm making it sound like I'm rubbing shoulders with them.
I understand.
You know, I'm not. I'm standing behind it.
You're not actually
downstairs.
Making it sound like that at all. No. You're but you are a reasonably close witness. And come here, can you confirm that Bill Gates isn't a lizard?
Do you know what? I had one experience with him, and I think it was those 50th birthdays. It was like, I was at a sushi station up on the deck making fresh sushi. And I think we're in Tahiti. And I talked to him for about, I'd say, 7 seconds. And he heard my accent. He was like, oh, you're from Ireland, are you? And I was like, yeah. That was it. And then 6 months later, we're on a different boat back in the Mediterranean, and he came on again, talked to him for 3 seconds, but he was like, oh, hiya, Irish.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was like, wow, like how is that guy who's meeting 1,000 people a day remembered that? So that was the only interaction I had with him. But no, he seemed normal. I was kind of listening in on his conversation because I wasn't far away, and he was talking about his kids going horse riding. It was the most boring conversation, you know, nothing exciting at all.
No, but it's fascinating just to hear fly on the wall stuff like this, especially from that kind of level of wealth. And did like movie stars or like pop stars and stuff come onto these yachts or whatever?
Yeah, there was, on that one, there was everybody, like, because it was Cannes and just the after party. So everybody would be there. I remember the one, I wasn't really starstruck, but the one that I was really starstruck at the time, if you remember, Ali G was, he was huge. It was like, I don't know, it was doing the movies or whatever.
Baron
and
Cohen.
He came on. Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen came on, and he was actually a big, dour sort of guy. He wasn't, you know, like the character at all. But he came on and I was a bit starstruck because it was so big at the time.
He's really serious sort of dude. He's one of those comedians who's actually in his private life really, like, he doesn't, you know, really serious sort of the side of it. Yeah.
like maybe even manic depressant or so. You know, the way a lot of comedians are, I don't know if that's true, but yeah, he was so dour and serious that I was like, Jesus, it really is, you're a great actor.
And your exposure to this world, did it have any effect on you at all, Niall? Were you able to see sort of, that's them and this is me and I don't necessarily want to aspire to that, or do I? I mean, did it change your views about something like, I mean, you're young, as we'll soon find out, you clearly were ambitious. Did it change your view of people in that milieu at all, and how maybe you may have seen your path?
Do you know what it did? And actually, in a bad way, at that stage in my life, because I would have been 26 or 27, it did change me towards being like, geez, I wouldn't mind a bit of this, you know, like I should have my own yacht. Was the thinking, and I was like, this would be great lifestyle, and like now I'd be horrified by that, but back then I was like, yeah, this is fantastic. I mean, money, you know, celebrities, movie stars, you're at Monaco Grand Prix, you're flying, you know, you do whatever you want. So it really did open my eyes to the possibilities of, I remember thinking like, God, this has all been paid for by Microsoft, like little computer things, you know, like little software. Yeah. I was like, you can make a lot of money for it. So that sort of connected in my head a little bit, yeah.
And then your world changed a little. So you got out of the chefing game and between the jigs and the reels, anyway, you eventually became a sort of a social media entrepreneur. Isn't that right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I got off the... got off the boat first, and it was a spectacular failure. The first business we set up with my friend, and we raised money. I had savings from the boats, and we started a business, and we went belly up within about 2-3 years. It was called iFoods. It was like, the idea was, sounded good, like all business ideas. It was like, we're going to make videos how to teach you how to cook. Yeah. And this is 2008, you know, like barely.
You were well ahead of Instagram.
Yeah, we were too far. I know this is a silly excuse, but we were too far ahead. Like the broadband wouldn't work. The phones weren't good enough. So we made all these videos and then nobody watched
Your
them.
Idea
so
was too
was
good. That's right. Your idea was too good. No. I mean, and that's not to be, that's not even to compliment you too much. Some people's ideas don't come at the right time.
That's exactly it. My next one did come at the right time because I saw that and that was a disaster. But then I saw everybody using social media and nobody was using it. You know, in Ireland, there was a few people on Twitter. You probably remember back, you know, the early days, there was, you know, a bit of Twitter and a bit of, you had a Facebook page or a Bebo, whatever it was you had. But I was really in that world and I could see that nobody had a clue. But I could, just from the previous thing, I could see that it was coming. So my next one, I was very lucky with the timing.
That was a
social media agency. So we're like a marketing agency, but we just helped the likes of the big banks and, you know, Bank of Ireland and Vodafone and, you know, all those people. All we did was set up Facebook pages for them, do little campaigns, but they didn't know what, you know, a Facebook was back then, you know.
No, so it's very similar now. I mean, it's very similar. Like Patrick, the producer of this show, I mean, he does podcasts for big, you know, companies, you know, and they're very similar. Like they want to know, hey, how do we get in on this podcasting thing? Do you just press a button and speak or what? You know, and then he takes them through the whole.
And you sort of think like, you know, you would think, oh, podcast, easy enough, just, you know, set it up. But when you're a big brand like that, like they're paying you for yourself or Patrick's expertise, like, you know, it's what's easy to you is not easy for them as a big brand. So that's where we fit in back then. Yeah.
And what was that business called?
Simply Zesty. So we were based in Dublin and we grew very quickly and we were bought by UTV, they were at the time. And that was, it was all media. And I sort of, then once we got bought, it was all, I mean, you work in the media world, all the suits sort of arrived, you know, I was fun and having, you know, doing creative stuff and all the sort of media suits arrived. And I was like, Jesus, out of here. 3 or 4 months later, I was like, I don't think I lasted 4 months after they arrived. I was just like, this is way too corporate for me.
Yeah. So, the success of Simply Zesty then, that gave you some money then, presumably. And were you enjoying the money? Was your mind kind of going back to the guys on the boat going, oh, I'm on my way here. Maybe, you know, get a nice car, get a nice house.
Yeah, I did that. I was stupid with it. Like I think it got, We sold it for like $1.5 million, which sounds like so much money, but by, like, I only owned, I think, 30% of the company. Then you have to pay taxes. Then you have to, what else? You give your mom and your dad, a holiday, and you do a load of stuff. I went, the first day I got the money, I went and bought a car in Dublin. Yeah. And not stupid stuff, but it was just, I wasted it. I didn't know what I was doing. So, I burned through that pretty quickly because I was also drinking and, being not responsible. So
you were fast living. You were drinking hard, partying hard, working hard.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, exactly. And it was, it's easy. I didn't enjoy it. No, looking back on it, I didn't. You should, because a lot of it, if you set up a business and then you sell it, it's something you've been building for a few years, or, you've put your heart and soul into it, and then suddenly you sell it, it's not yours. So there's like a sort of a grief period, which is, sounds really weird, but you don't have your baby anymore. Your thing that you were so focused on, some other guys in suits own it. So it was, not what I, when you dream of stuff. It wasn't what I thought it was, how it was cracked up to be, if that makes sense.
No, it's interesting that you can make that analogy, that it's like a little death in the family, and that in a way there's a grieving period afterwards. Interesting. But you didn't stop there. You went into another business, and this was Love in Dublin, wasn't it?
Yeah, I just started that as a blog, Love in Dublin, just myself. I was bored sitting at home, and I just started writing some restaurant reviews, and it just grew. Yeah, it's like a city guide, sometimes controversial. I kind of wrote the reviews from my heart. Because I got into my head somehow that I had to be just honest with the reviews, which was fine for restaurants. But then I started writing about other stuff, and that wasn't
opinion pieces.
And I was trying to be like clever or cutting edge, and I think in media you have to really, if you own a successful business, you have to sort of be a lot more disciplined and stuff like that. And I was a bit, I might even have been drunk writing some of the stuff, like genuinely. So it wasn't, it was successful, but it wasn't, it was successful, but it was, I didn't love it either, I guess that's what I'm saying. But at the time it was successful, yeah.
And so you got out of that as well, yeah?
I did, I there were some investors, and then I sold my share to them, and I left in about 2017, I think.
Wow. Okay. And then, so let's just summarize it all. You've had a period of high intensity chefing, which perhaps could lead to burnout as well. You've had partying hard, working hard in an emerging social media scene in Dublin, in which you did very well and bought your parents a holiday and got a car and blah, 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 sad grieving. And then another business starting up and did well out of that as well. And then you decide you want out of this. You're feeling a bit burnt out.
Yeah. Well, I was always an alcoholic, functioning alcoholic, very bad alcoholic, had depression, had suffered from anxiety, all those three things. I was sort of self-medicating through depression and anxiety. Even when I was working, I'd be going into client pitches and stuff like that, like absolutely dying, maybe having a Valium before the pitch to calm myself down. I was always like functioning alcoholic, so that went on for a good 20 years really. Like I'd have dry spots where I'd be sober for 3 months or 6 months or whatever, but it was really quite a bad, like, 2-3 bottles of wine a day type alcohol. I remembered, like, that's why I don't spend much time in Dublin anymore, because I just find it too tempting to walk past a pub and just duck in the door for a nice pint to get. I remember all those places in Dublin that I could duck into, like I remember vividly, like, where your guys' office is there on the, I don't know if you're there anymore, in the Diggs Lane, or that little lane,
right,
where
Marconi
the
house, today, Diggs Lane.
Yeah, yeah. Is it more? Yeah. I remember going to meetings around those streets, and I'd sort of duck into the Harry Lemon for a gin and tonic,
Peter's
to calm
pub,
myself on the way to Peter Top. Yeah, the Drury Buildings. I've been in all those places or I'd take my laptop and pretend I'm working for the afternoon and just have a few pints around there. So, yeah, very, very functional alcoholic, but very miserable at the same time.
And did you know at the time you were a functional alcoholic, Niall, or is it only in retrospect that you can look back and say you were a functional alcoholic?
No, I definitely knew. Like, I'd done therapy and found myself in very dark places sometimes, binges and mentally tough situations. So no, I definitely knew, but I'd when you're an alcoholic like that, I'd sort of come back and make new, you feel great after 3 months. So then I'd make a rule like, oh, I'm only going to drink shandies, or I'll only go out on Friday nights, or, you know, whatever. You have a million rules. Mm. And then it would all fall apart again from there. So I was very up and down. Or I'd always give up booze at Christmas after that. And then, you know, you'd get through January. I always remember in Ireland, I'd get through, and then the Six Nations starts, you know, around like
February,
early February. And then I'd get through the first weekend. And then by the second weekend, you know, like everybody's going to the pub. There's a huge Ireland match on. And I'd just find it impossible. I'd just crack, you know, I'd be like, so there'd always be, I just found Ireland especially a really hard place. That's why I moved to Thailand.
It is.
You know, dark, cold in the winter. Yeah. Not so much to do, maybe culturally and stuff like that. Sometimes, if you know, a lot of the cultures, it's hopefully changing, but a lot of the culture was, you know, booze, but you know, pubs, and
it is changing
even work.
Big time, Niall.
Is it? Yeah,
it is. Yeah,
yeah, I can imagine.
Even statistics now about alcohol consumption is like 30% down on 33% down, a third down on maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, when we were growing up, the only thing was, you know, the pub. You'd go, where would you go on a Friday night? Like, you're not going to go to a Pilates class or, you know, like you'd go to the pub, and that was it. And if you didn't go to the
unless
pub,
you could drink called. During Pilates, which would be interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You could have gin and tonic Pilates. Yeah. That's a good business. Yeah.
Pints and Pilates.
And then you'd be called, it's much better. Yeah.
Great name for a business. I don't want to give you any ideas now. You're very good at these ideas.
No, I'm out of business, definitely. But somebody should take that and run with it. Pints and Pilates,
and Camille,
like a dating, you know, dating site.
I'm interested in a little bit of it, if you don't mind indulging me slightly, just for a moment, the slightly more maudlin side of this. When you said binges, what kind of form did the binges take in terms of? Were they solo efforts, or would you go out into town and see who you'd meet, or would you stay in your flat and go, I'm just going to drink myself into oblivion, or both?
Yeah, so for alcoholics, it probably, people have a sense that it might be glamorous, that you're out at a party every night and you're maybe doing cocaine or, you know, dance parties or stuff like that. It's not like that. I would start, let's say, like, I was on a dry patch, and there might be like an award ceremony on a Thursday night, or there might be a, you know, an event or something is happening. So I'd start off, and it would be very social and very fun, and we'd stay out, and then I'd have a bit of a hangover Friday, and then I'd have a few pints with the work crew or whoever. But, you know, I would be the only person then for the third day drinking. And by the third day, I'm sort of, I'm scared of the world, don't want to go outside. So I'll just get 12 cans of Guinness, and I'll watch, you know, two United games two football games and a rugby match. And I'll just drink at home. But then by the Sunday, you're waking up at 11 and you've got the shakes, and you're like, sure, I'll just get straight on the wine because that'll stop the shakes. And, you know, by the end of it, you're absolutely drinking on your own, miserable. Don't want to go outside. You'd go to the spa the first time and get a big bag of booze, and then you're back there at 6 o'clock, you know, embarrassed that you're seeing the same person again, and you're buying another two bottles of wine. So no, it's not glam. It might the first night might be glamorous, but by the end of it, it's really lonely, miserable, sad, depressing.
I think a lot of Irish people can relate to some of what you're saying. You know, the idea of having a desperate, desperate hangover, and then having a few drinks to take the edge off. And then that feeling the day after you take the edge off of you're a bit flat, which is, it's that flatness. You're kind of, your fingers are numb, your hands are numb, your hair is a bit, your hair is dry and wiry. And you're sort of a bit flat, and you're unresponsive in conversations.
And you're anxious.
Anxious, the, you know, fear of Christ. And, you know, but I suppose, whereas a lot of people might go, I feel like that on Saturday after the Friday, and I level out on Saturday, and then I recover on Sunday. You maybe took it into the third and fourth days.
See, my problem was always that I knew that no matter how bad you felt, like you just described, I knew that two margaritas in a Mexican restaurant and you're back flying, or, you know, six cans of Guinness, watching a bit of Formula One, whatever, you're you're back. Mm. I just, in my head, I was like, why would I suffer through that when I can just get, you know.
Absolutely.
I'll definitely be suffering for the first, first hour is not going to be good, but it's never failed once to get you back on high, you know, so.
And what kind of a drunk were you, Niall? Were you a talkie drunk, talkative drunk, happy drunk, angry drunk?
I would say maybe talkative, You probably thought I was hilarious in my own mind, you know, as we all do. But no, I'd say like maybe a lonely drunk as well. Like I said, the first, I just like to just get blackout drunk, because when you have businesses, you have a lot of people asking you questions all day, a lot of decisions to make, and I've got stuff from my childhood as well with my mom and different things. So just, I really like it's very hard to explain being an alcoholic. It's not enjoyable, you know, like you're doing it just to escape your own head. You're not doing it to get tipsy or to make friends or to be funny, or
you're doing it to delete stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing it. And then you've got that 4 or 5 hours. I just used to love being drunk because I wouldn't even think about anything. I'd be watching YouTube videos of concerts and stuff. I could just forget, you know, about life and just escape it.
Yeah. And an interesting word you use there, escape it, because you found another way of escaping it, I suppose. You said, listen, fuck this for a game of soldiers. I'm going to change things around here. I'm going to go to Thailand.
Yeah, I remember I was in the weather used to get me, you know, in November, December in Ireland, England, and it's dark at 4 o'clock when you're coming out of the office. And I was just like, I used to go to Thailand. I found it in about 2014 for 3 weeks in December to just, the sunshine really break the winter up, and it's got a stereotype Thailand, you know, partying and all that stuff. The place where I came and where I live now is actually like health, yoga places, gyms, beach, smoothies. It's sort of a health area. So I said, right, I keep failing here at getting sober, so I'm going to go and try and do it in Thailand. And I just took that. I was lucky I had a bit of savings and I could do that. You know, I didn't have to work for a couple of years. So I just so frustrated about being constantly
on this treadmill.
Yeah. Hamster wheel. And also, which I think a lot of people feel that, you know, not just me, but I just wanted something different. And then the alcoholism and the depression and everything. I said, I'll just clean break. Let's start a new life was my thinking.
Did it work?
No, it got worse. It was like, I came to Thailand and it worked for a certain amount of time, but then there was a terrible combination of things. It was like, I came with a girlfriend at the time, Sarah, so we broke up, just a normal breakup, but it's, you know, breakup's never nice. Then it was COVID, so it was like a free pass to drink. You know, everybody in
absolutely
COVID was having,
I understand what you mean, yeah.
Drinks at 2 o'clock and whatever,
In a sense, everybody in the world was an alcoholic or a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, so I could really double down then because there was nobody to tell you to stop. So there was that, and then
I love the way the mind rationalizes this sort of stuff.
100%. Yeah, you're just like, Jesus, brilliant, free. You know, free. We're all in it. We're all alcoholics now, like you said. I just went completely off the rails, and that's when I ended up in hospital, because also there was nobody to stop me. Then I'm so far away from home, and there's no response. I could go for a beer at 7:30 in the morning. Yeah. There was no like, you know, stigma or whatever.
Yeah, and there was no Irish person at Spar giving you a funny look.
Yeah. You wouldn't get, exactly. I couldn't get away with that. And, you know, Dublin, or you'd be scared somebody'd see you, or, you know, you could get away with it at home maybe, but here I could just get on the bike and go and have a beer.
Yeah. You're very comfortable talking about it, Niall.
Yeah, I mean, I try and do it because I think it helps other people. And I also don't have a boss or you know, somebody to answer to. There's a lot of people, like, you walk around any office in Ireland or wherever, there's at least, you know, the amount of people suffering from depression and anxiety, silently, alcoholism, God knows what else, grief, losing children, drug abuse, you know, everything. There's, people are great at putting up these big facades, you know. We're all great at it. So I just talk about it because I know there's people who listen who are like, Jesus, yeah, I'm like that. That's, you know, if he's saying it, that might, you know, I just think it might help somebody. Yeah. So that's why I don't mind talking about it.
It's nice. Do you, describe this the way it got worse and worse, and you hit rock bottom in Thailand. But you also describe that as being a revelatory moment, and a moment of release and a moment of happiness.
100%. Not at the time, because it was horrific physically. Really, really. Like, I think I had a mental breakdown, to be honest. Like, they didn't actually, you know, give me a piece of paper or anything saying that. But I was in the hospital. But at the time I finished, I was on about 4 Valiums a day, which is like a lot.
Is it?
Yeah, like the 10 milligrams, if anybody knows, that's a lot. And then 2 bottles of wine at least a day. And then about 6 beers and a bottle of whiskey. And people would be listening to that, they'd be listening to that saying, like, you're not a big guy. Like, that's impossible. He's exaggerating that, you know, like, not at all. Because I'd wake up at 7 and I'd need a bottle of wine to calm down, like, not even joking, a Valium and a bottle of wine to calm down, and then you'd have 6 beers, and then you'd be sort of half pissed, so you'd have to go back to sleep, wake up at lunchtime, I'll go a bit easier, 6 beers, then in the evening, restaurant, bottle of wine. You can get through that amount of stuff, and then I'd be blackout drunk, and then the next day it starts again. So I arrived in hospital at death's door. Like, I couldn't function, couldn't barely walk, to be honest. I had to be put into a little wheelchair thing and taken over, and then they put me on, I don't even know what they put me on, but I was having, it's very dangerous when you're drinking that much and you stop, you need proper medication. So I was not in a good place.
Okay, and go on, continue, what happened then?
I was in there for about 3 or 4 days. And they were giving me, I don't know, needles of stuff, whatever it was, to calm me down. And I was like, my hands were like claws, like that. Like, I was just, you know, when you, like you're saying there, you get the fear a bit. You're a bit like, I had the fear times 2000. Mm. Literally, I was like, I thought I was going to die every second. I was like,
cramping.
Just make it through. Yeah, exactly. And like little spasms and twitches.
Cramping with
and
fear.
Just,
I understand. Understand.
Yeah. So I got through that, but I was getting through 10 seconds at a time. I was like, if just get through 10 seconds and you'll be okay. And I remember the reason, Snoop was my dog then, my only dog, who I'd brought from Ireland with me. And I just remember, I was that drunk. I remember waking up in the hospital being like, fuck, Snoop said I've left him at home. So I got my friends to go and get him and look after him. But I only sort of battled through it for him at that stage. I was like, I thought I was dead. I really did. I was like, this is it. And what the revelation in that moment was, right, you're going to die. And that's, if anybody's been sick, I don't know if you've been sick or, you know, car crashes or something. Like, if you kind of think a bit differently when your life is, you know, I was like, Jesus, what a miserable life. I was thinking, I was like, yeah, you had a couple of businesses, you were a chef. Nobody's going to give a shit in 6 months, you know, your parents and your best friends and your, you know, the people who go to your funeral, whatever, they'll remember you. But I was like, he's like, what a meaningless load of shite that was. Like, really, that's what I was thinking about. It's like, you know, you're
brilliant. Yeah, you're, I love your thinking.
That's how I thought of it. I was like, you know, those sort of like those campaigns I'm doing a Facebook page for a bank. And at the time, you think it's the most important thing, and you know, the client's calling you up and you're like, this is so important. I was just lying there going, like, a Facebook page for a bank, like that, like, you know, it's the least important stuff you could ever be working on. So it was a good realization. So I just, that's when I decided if I lived somehow, I would change my life completely.
To what?
That's what I didn't know at the time. The only two things I could think of when I was in that bed dying was Snoop, my dog, dogs in general. And I was thinking a lot about playing football as an 8-year-old. It's so random, but I could remember goals I'd scored as an 8-year-old. Yeah. You know, they're probably exaggerated in your head. Yeah. You're dribbling past a load of guys in top corner, you know, nothing like that. Yeah. But that's what so I was like, if I get through it, maybe I'll go and coach kids football or that dog, something. That's all I was thinking at that time. I was like, if I get out of this, I'm going to do something that next time I die, or next time, you know, I'm lying in this position, I'll be proud of myself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. So I get it. So you feel like you were sort of saying to yourself, I want another chance. And if I'm given another chance, I'm going to do something useful. Like that people say, be useful for other people, worthwhile. Yeah. Do something that means something, that isn't a Facebook page for a bank, and give myself a chance to look back and go, that was a life slightly better lived than the one I was looking at.
100%. That's exactly it. And it's, I didn't know what that was at the time, and I didn't like rise up out of the bed and start helping dogs. Like, I was in bits for months. Like, I remember getting out of the hospital and I was like, do you know how stupid I was? I got out and I was like, right, let's go. I'll run a 3K. This is 4 days out of getting out of the hospital. I got 100 yards down the road and had like a panic attack and had to get back into bed.
So you really,
like,
body, I was, your body and mind were catastrophized.
Gone. I came back into the laptop. I'd lost all my bank cards. I had no money because I had money, but it was in my bank and stuff. And you know the way you have, like, you have to verify a phone or whatever. Like, it's two steps. I couldn't remember.
Anything.
Could not remember my password that I've had for, you know, 20 years on my laptop, or my phone number. I just couldn't. I was staring at it, the laptop, and I was like, yeah, Jesus, this is bad. Yeah. Like, you've hard erased your brain. Luckily, it started to come back, but it was pretty grim the first, I would say, 2 months.
Yeah. You went back to company default mode.
Literally. Yeah. There was a few days where, like, it was January, and I remember I was like, okay, the goal today is drive down to a little local park and you've got to walk 1K, you know, walk just 1,000 steps. And some days I had to put it off. I'd be standing at the door being like, okay, well, this is it. We can do it. Oh. And then I'd be like, no, back to the sofa. We'll tackle that tomorrow. Okay. So it was really, I was determined to do it. Like, there was no chance of drinking or anything like that, but I was just the body was.
So you gently nursed yourself screwed back to one step at a time into a little bit of early stages of health.
Yeah, exactly.
And then tell me about, you talk about Snoop, your dog, and dogs you mentioned as well in general, and you mentioned being an 8-year-old boy scoring goals in your mind and dogs.
Yeah,
you obviously had an early adoration love for dogs. Was it, did you have dogs as
yeah
a kid?
But I was never allowed one. No, you know, the parents, I give my dad a hard time about it now. He never allowed it to me because he thought that he would end up looking after it. So the first one I got was after I sold my Simply Zesty, the first business in Dublin. I was like, my dream was to get my own dog, because I got a little house, and I was on a spending spree that day. I got the car, a house, and then I was like, the dog. Once I get the dog out, like, this is, oh, I had, for the last 2 years of Simply Zesty, I had a picture of a dog on my screen as my sort of motivation to just, you know, get to that place. So I got Snoop, and I loved them, and then there's a lot of street dogs in Thailand, but I'd fed them a few times, like drunk or at a 7-Eleven I'd stop off, but I'd never done anything serious with them.
And why dogs? See, I see all your dog stuff on Twitter, yeah, X, right? And it's absolutely brilliant, fascinating, and I love all the dogs, and I love all the way you analyze the faces of the dogs and the way you look at their eyes and tell us about their eyes and what their eyes are saying. And I like the way you say that dogs can smile and, you know, so why dogs?
I do you know what? I've been asked this question a lot by people, and I've kind of figured out the answer, I think. It's quite deep, but
this is a very shallow podcast. No room for that. No, go deep.
No, on a very simple level, I just love their live in the moment. They're the friendliest creatures. They're always up for an adventure. They're just, you know, simple. They just love food, walk, and they live in the moment. But then on a deeper level, I think that, like, my mum walked out when I was like 12, 13 years old. So that's where a lot of my trauma comes from. And just vanished overnight and left us for another man. And I thought we were a happy family. So I think dogs are really, really loyal, and they'll never sort of walk out on you. They're always by your side, and they're always they're the perfect companion, really, you know. So at an emotional level, I just love their loyalty, and they're just so simple, loyal, beautiful, fun loving creatures. I love other animals, but not the same as dogs. I just love dogs.
So in a sense, Professor Rosenstock here speaking, but in a sense, while you learned from your natural mother that love wasn't unconditional, in fact it was somehow conditional, that this conditionality could be replaced by the unconditional, unquestioning love of a dog, or companionship at least, or loyalty.
Yeah, I think that's it in a nutshell. I mean, I love them for everything else, but that definitely is a big central role. Yeah, I think I just love their unconditional love, really. They're, you know, they're very pure creatures.
Mm. That's lovely. And of course, your life now is concerned with helping dogs, helping stray dogs, taking them in, finding them good veterinarian assistance and help, feeding them, making them better. And making them better, and then what?
To explain what we do, like, I started off feeding them, and I was like, I just buy a big bag of food, and I was like, this is great, I'll feed the dogs and I'll fix the world like this. But actually they needed vet care, and they need sterilizing, which is spaying or neutering, which is kind of boring for people, but there's so many here. There's 8 million street dogs in Thailand, so we're trying to, with a charity now, we're trying to control the population and do bigger stuff as well. But the bit that I get most excited about, and that people like online, I think, is sort of the makeovers, finding a dog that's really down on its luck and telling a story about it and bringing it back. So that sort of, that gets people interested. But the work we do is actually more behind the scenes, boring stuff that, you know, are you interested in me telling you how many dogs we vaccinated? You know, like, you might be interested for a couple of minutes, but you're not going to come in on the bus on your phone and watch dogs getting vaccinated, you know, or sterilized. But people, so we do the fun stuff to help us do the boring stuff that really makes a difference.
Okay, your book is called Tina, the dog that changed the world. Who's Tina? Tell me about Tina.
Tina Turner I named her because I found her on a chain up in the mountain. She was a golden retriever, and she was she'd been abused, not physically abused, but puppies. She'd been used for puppies breeding, and she was on a short chain. And I saw a picture of her, and she was just the most malnourished, saddest looking dog I've ever seen in my life. So I rescued her. And I took her to my house. She nearly died in the first few days because I was like, I'll give her a big feed. Like, she needs a feed. She's starving. And it nearly killed her because they bloat up if you feed them too much. It's called refeeding syndrome. Mm. And so it nearly killed her in the first night. She stomach exploded. But anyway, she survived, and she grew into an unbelievable dog. But I only had her for 4 months, and she was back like a gorgeous golden retriever. Beautiful. And then I got the call, her test results. Chronic kidney failure. She was going to die. She had 2 months, they told me. I think she only lasted maybe 3 or 4 weeks. Mm. So it was she was the best dog ever, but it's a sad story. But then at the same time, loved her so much. She had a great end to her life. So she's inspired me to do so much more. And she's the sort of driving force behind everything that I do.
Wow. And why Tina as opposed to all the other dogs that you've encountered and helped?
I don't know. It's like, you know, why do you get married to somebody, or why do you like a certain pop singer or whatever? I just loved Tina. She just like a soul dog type thing. She just really struck me as the most, she lived her life in the moment. A little bit, I suppose, she was shackled up her whole life as well. And she was only with me 6 months, but she just got up in the morning. She didn't think about any of that stuff in the past that had gone through. She was just happiness and let's go on an adventure. Let's just, she was great with the other dogs, great with people, you know, like golden retrievers.
So she had a fantastic personality.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. So she was just a radiant sort of personality, you know, like a human, one of those humans who walk into the room and you're like, wow, that's an amazing personality.
So the dog had charisma.
100%. Yeah. She had charisma. People, like, I think I imagine these things sometimes, you know, or create the story or whatever, but people picked up on it via their screens. They were like, that dog is different. And so, yeah.
Do you think dogs are smart?
They're not exactly going to be, you know, doing the crossword or... they're smart in some ways. In some ways, I like the way that they're not smart because they don't overthink things. You know what I mean? Like us humans are like, maybe think, what's he thinking? What's she thinking? Yeah. Like, they'll just have a scrap over their dinner, but then 10 minutes later, they'll forget it. So I don't think they're massively smart, but I do think they're like, they're very emotionally smart. Like they have me wrapped around their fingers or their paws, you know, like they know what time their dinner's out. Yeah. They know how to get attention. Yeah. The way I think about it is like they used to be out in the fields, you know, whatever they used to do, fighting, you know, fighting for their prey. Now they're in our feckin' beds. They're walking around in, you know, prams and stuff like that. So they're definitely not stupid. They know how to manipulate us.
They've done well. Do you think
they have.
Do you think dogs can, like, Do you think, I don't know how much you've looked into this, if at all you have. I mean, do you think dogs have like heightened senses, emotional senses even, that we're not even aware of as humans? So for example, I grew up on a farm with dogs, right? And like just wild dogs everywhere. So obviously from the age of 4, I was dogs in my face, licking dogs' faces. It's just normal. I was going out to see a little dog called Sandy. She'd have puppies all the time. I'd go out and you'd see the lovely puppies. And then my grandfather would come. We were farmers. He was a farmer. And then he'd take me down to the stream to drown all the puppies. And that was quite dark and traumatic, but it was part of farm life. I didn't, you know, at the beginning I was a bit stunned and I used to cry a little, but then on the fifth time of doing it, even though it used to be sad, it used to know that this is what we have to do. Right? And, but at the same time, sometimes now when I meet a dog, there's a few, we don't have a dog here in the house, but sometimes a few of the neighbors have dogs. And when the neighbor's dogs meet me, they go, "Oh, she likes you." And I go, "Yeah, it's possible. That's possible, because the dog can probably sense that I'm a dog person." In other words, whatever pheromones I'm giving off, or whatever sense I'm giving off, or attitude, the dog can probably feel, in dog world, this guy knows dogs, likes dogs, probably will like me.
100%. I see it all the time. If we're doing a rescue or something, if the wrong person's with me, I'm like, Jesus, it's going to be hard. They don't have the body. I think it's body language, or so just the way you just, you know dogs and you know how to walk up to them. Mm. And they really pick up on, I don't know. Yeah. Smell, I suppose. But I think body language is a huge one as well. Yeah. They're very smart. And then what you're talking about, the farm and stuff there, that's what I'm dealing with at the moment in Thailand. It's a poorer country, like Ireland was back in the day, rural settings. I mean, if you've got chickens and that's your livelihood, and a stray dog comes along and eats them, you're going to shoot the dog. That's the sort of law of the land, you know, which is very hard for Western people to understand. You know, if you're walking around Dublin or London or New York and you see some of the things, like I've seen dogs stabbed, shot, poisoned, everything. So it's more of an education piece as well. Like it's just such a different world.
Tell me briefly about then the book, Tina, the Dog Who Changed the World. What is it? Obviously it's about Tina and how she changed you, maybe, but what form does the book take?
Yeah, I think I wrote it just because I get a lot of messages from people who obviously suffer from everything, you know, sickness, cancer, depression, everything. Because I think they sort of latch on to the dogs for a bit of hope. I started it when the Ukraine war had just started. I think it was the tail end of COVID. There was like a cost of living crisis, everything, you know, as it is now, the world's, you know, on fire, disaster. So I said, I'll just put some dogs out there. And I didn't really want to be in the videos because I just didn't. I thought, so I said I'd start talking over them, which people seemed to like. Mm. And so it's always been upbeat content. Like what I have to deal with is horrendous some of the days, you know, it's really bad because we just see terrible stuff. But I try and just put a positive spin on it. So give them little funny names, give them characters. And I won't share the stuff that's bad. You know, you're not going to go on, if you know, Instagram and see 10 puppies have died. You know, like I'll try and find the good stories to share because I don't want to like depress people. So yeah, the book is that. It's just like an upbeat, and then I try and just tell my story that explains that, you know, I think a lot of people latch on to that as well. Like I was 40, whatever, when I had that breakdown, like 41, I think. And by all outside metrics, you know, selling a business and Thailand and living, you know, people's dream life or whatever. But I was miserable and I was never at a happy day really in my life. So, and hamster wheel, like you said. So I just try and explain in the book that, you know, it took me 25 years to get sober and find my purpose, for want of a better word. And that anybody else can as well, you know.
How's your physical and mental health now?
Oh, like 90% better. I still have the odd dark day.
Can you walk a kilometre?
It's funny, like laughing back at it, like it's I couldn't literally, I don't think I could even do 100 metres back then. But yeah, no, I'm much better. I still have the odd bad day, but taking booze and Valium out of the equation just means that it's, you know, a bad day is not what it used to be. So
what about what about your addictive personality though? I mean, how do you deal with that in the sense that alcoholism, as you've kind of alluded to, alcoholism came from a place for you. It's buried somewhere. It's about unresolved childhood trauma. It's about deleting. It's about hiding. It's about escaping. That sort of addictive compulsion is often replaced with something else, or there's often a battle to replace it with something else. I mean, do you use the 12 steps program? Do you use some form of to deal with your addiction?
I probably should that wasn't for me. 12 steps or I tried rehab and stuff like that. Just wasn't for me. I just found it a bit preachy or something, you know, religious, or I don't know. It just wasn't for me. It just never worked. Didn't like it.
Yeah.
What worked for me, and it's not a good answer, is like just getting the absolute shite scared out of me in that hospital. Like I just went as low as I could possibly go. And I was just like,
that's a hard rewire.
I'm not recommending it to anybody at all. But it did work for me. It just was. I remember just after it happened, I read somewhere a quote or something, and it said, "People will back you like 100% if you've let them. You know, if you're an alcoholic and you've nearly died and whatever, you know, they'll back you the first time and they'll come back. But it said something along the lines of the second time, you know, you'll be down to your mom and dad and your very best friend are the only people. They'll have given up on you." And I was like, Jesus, that's pretty bad. So I was just like, there's not going to be a second time. I'm done. So for me, it was just the fear that got me. Yeah, that was, because I tried everything else, you know, green smoothies on a Monday morning, 12 steps. I went to an AA meeting in Dublin, everything, and nothing had worked.
Mm. And Thailand is a nice place to live?
It's unbelievable, yeah. It's really nice weather, really cheap. Although I don't know if you watch Netflix, that White Lotus.
I did, I was just about to ask you about that. I saw it all, yeah.
Yeah. It's a disaster for us because it's like I'm on Koh Samui where they filmed it.
Yeah.
So the place is just like rammed now full of like Chinese, Americans.
They've all come to have the White Lotus experience.
100%. So it's like I'm cursing it. It wasn't exactly undiscovered, but that's really like put it on the map.
It was famous
so
already, but I mean, this is the same with the Italian one in White Lotus. I remember looking it up the day after it ended, just for a laugh, the hotel.
Yeah.
And hotel rooms were $49,000 a night.
But you know what? It's the same here, but then you get people still want the experience, so they'll buy the $49 a night hostel White Lotus experience, you know, with the White Lotus cocktail. You can get the cheap version of it as well. Don't worry. I'm wondering, does it taper off maybe a little bit as the seasons move on?
Of course it will. And the next White Lotus will come then. It'll be all forgotten.
Yeah, hopefully. I do miss home sometimes in Ireland, and I go to podcasts, and I remember I was suffering from depression, or like when you get depression, I just end up in bed for a day, and I just missed home a bit, and I was like going through the Irish charts, and I must have put on about 4 or 5 episodes of yours in a row, because I was like, this, it couldn't be more Irish.
Thank you.
You know, the gags and the
the
inside jokes and just the stuff that you would only get if you're around Dublin, and I was It was really enjoyable. That and Crime World.
Crime World. Of course, we've had Nicola Tallant on the podcast as well. You couldn't get anything more Irish than Crime World. Daniel Kinahan is lost in Dubai.
And exactly.
He's a scumbag of the finest magnitude.
I know all the characters from Dublin gangland. I'm like, why the hell do I know this?
This is the Viper.
I have no need to know.
The last thing you need to hear now is the Viper apparently ended up in Koh Samui.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen, Niall, I really am absolutely thrilled to have spoken to you. You have a lovely personality. You're I don't know. I said to you earlier on, you're comfortable talking. You're settled. You're relaxed. Your shoulders are relaxed. I don't know. There's something in your tone that I really like. And congratulations to you on everything you've achieved personally with yourself.
Oh, that's a lovely, lovely way to sum it up. I really appreciate that.
That's fantastic. Thanks a million, Niall. And my thanks to Niall Harbison for that really, really brilliant conversation. And I hope you at home listening to this found that too. I hope it translated. Tell one other person about this podcast if you can and if you liked it. Subscribe, follow. We really appreciate that. It builds up the numbers and continues to give us encouragement to do more and more podcasts. Thank you for joining me. See you same time, same place next week. Bye.